do you live when you have experienced the grace and salvation of God? Just in case anyone has missed over the last few weeks, this is what we've been looking at. That we've been seeing in the book of Deuteronomy. We haven't always read the passage in Deuteronomy, but you find it in Deuteronomy chapter 5. And it's about how to respond. The whole book of Deuteronomy is about how to respond. Not about how to earn, but about how to respond to the amazing love and faithfulness of God. As you may know, I love a good rugby match, and it always amazes me how much difference it makes to play at home. There are probably a few factors, but you know when a team has the overwhelming support of a home crowd, the normal response is, of course, greater commitment, higher intensity, sharper focus, and better play. They may not be the better team, but who doesn't want to give their all in front of a crowd that will keep on supporting whether you win, lose, or draw? Deuteronomy is about responding. It's all about responding to the amazing love and grace of God. And if God's people, either at that time in Moses' day or in ours, if God's people are not responding to his love and grace with greater commitment and higher intensity and sharper focus and better living, well, then the problem must be losing sight of who he is and what he's done. The problem must be that we've begun to believe lies about him, that he's always demanding and impossible to please. The problem must be that we're not seeing the reality that he is a giving, bountiful, generous God who gives what we don't deserve, whose love is rock solid, and who will never let us down. We say it every week, but the laws of God are in that context. He heard their cries. He saved them from slavery in Egypt. He mercifully brought them out in dramatic style through the Red Sea to himself. And then he gave them his law so they could enjoy the blessing of living under his rule. Today, we're about 3,500 years later from when the law was given to Moses at Mount Sinai. But obeying God's law is still the way to respond to his unbreaking love. In fact, if anything, our response has got to be greater because we see his love more clearly. You know, they remembered, the Hebrew people, the Israelites remembered God's, they remembered God the Redeemer bringing them out of Egypt. We remember God the Redeemer giving his one and only Son to die for us on the cross so that we could be with him forever. And so surely our response has got to be even greater than theirs because we see more clearly his amazing love. And so we come to verse 18 in Deuteronomy 5 in the Ten Commandments. The response that we're called for, the response that is called for is you shall not commit adultery. In light of God's faithfulness to us, in light of God's faithfulness and mercy to his people, he says, you shall not commit adultery. Now, four points. You and I long for faithful, enduring love. But while we do indeed long for faithful, enduring love, we have to be honest and acknowledge that the seeds of adultery lie within us all. The result can be really ugly, but despite ourselves, lastly, our God is a faithful God. First of all, we long for faithful, enduring love. God has set a longing for permanence in the human heart. Literature, poetry, love songs, people are always expressing this desire for love that will never die. I mean, when did you ever hear a love song that went like this? I love you passionately, totally, you alone, until further notice. Like has anyone ever written that or sung that? We recoil. We recoil against that kind of shallowness. However much people are scared of commitment today, and that much is plain to see, nevertheless, it remains a fact that none of us are impressed and none of us are moved by words of temporary love. So if a man wants to live with you and share your bed, but he isn't prepared to marry you first, then you should dropkick him into touch Because he may as well be saying, I love you, darling, I really do, until further notice. And even the man who says that he cannot commit is kidding himself about what he really wants. Because however much our hormones will settle for something pretty shallow and short-lived, our souls want something that will last. Nobody wants to be just one of many. Nobody wants to be used and then discarded. And the whole tragedy of broken love is that we hoped it would last forever. I've given the illustration at probably every wedding I've ever done, so most of you will have heard this from Timothy Keller, but I can't think of a better way to make the point of what we all long for. He says, imagine I go home today and my wife says those three little words that we all love to hear. I love you. If I'm wise, I will respond by saying, honey, I love you too. A girl, however, likes to know that you mean it, so she might say to me, and just remind me, why do you love me? At this point, I'm in trouble. Because if I say, well, darling, it's your good looks and your perfect shape, that's why I love you. She might say, yeah, but what if I have 19 children and I just don't have this shape anymore? Will you love me then? Well, darling, you see, I love you because of our shared activities. We've just so much in common. And I love it. What we do, you know, the time we spend together. She might say, yeah, but what if I have health problems and we can't share all those activities anymore? Well, darling, I mean, I love you because of your great skin and your eyes. They're so captivating. She might say, yeah, but haven't you heard of aging? She might say yes. I might say yes, but I love you because of your great wit. Your wit and your personality. You know, I love to be around you. You know, you're just so funny and you know. She might say, yeah, but what if I have a really serious bout of depression? Will you love me then? Well, darling, I love you because of your character. You know, your great character. You're just someone I look up to so much. You're a virtuous woman, and I am so impressed with that, and I love that about you. She might say, but what if I have a great moral lapse? Will you love me then? And what she really wants to know is that I love her just because I love her, no matter what she is like. Now, it's nice to be loved because of certain attributes we may have, but ultimately we want to know that we're going to be loved no matter what. And there isn't a person here today who doesn't want to be loved in that way, no matter what. And yet, if we're honest, even the best marriages are somewhat conditional. Because there are many reasons, of course, that bring a couple together. There are many reasons that any given couple is attracted to each other, and that makes sense. But what if all those reasons that brought you together, what if all those things that you found attractive to each other in the first place, what if all those things change? What if all those things disappear? Where will we find one who will never let us down, no matter what? The answer, of course, is God alone. He knows all our needs, and he knows all our hurts. But here's point two. While we do indeed long for faithful, enduring love, we have to be honest and acknowledge that the seeds of adultery lie within us all. Now, I've got to be careful here, because especially on a subject like this, where there's been so much hurt, there is such a thing as false guilt. There is such a thing as false guilt. And therefore, while we all need to see how we all fall short of the seventh commandment, we also need to make sure that we're not carrying around any false guilt. Sometimes people blame themselves for a lot of stuff that is simply not their fault. I remember hearing an American author and seminary professor, Steve Brown, and he talked about his alcoholic father, and he shared one very vivid memory of his dad throwing spaghetti at the kitchen wall in a fit of rage. And he was only a little boy when it happened, and he remembers it really vividly. He was sitting in his high chair at the time, and all he could think of was, what did I do wrong? What did I do wrong? And you can imagine that there would have been many times when he felt that there was something wrong with him, that for some reason he had always been a disappointment to his father. And as an older man, he now looks back on his life and can see the ways in which he punished himself for guilt that was not actually his. God does not want us to carry around any false guilt. He knows when it's a case of being sinned against. But at the same time, the commandments search our own hearts, don't they? And we all fall short, not just of this one, but all the commandments. While the essence of adultery is infidelity, the sin first and foremost of a married person, remember that every commandment stands for a whole category of sins. So in other words, if God forbids us to commit adultery, then the flip side is that he commands us to love and to love faithfully. And any failure to do that is ultimately a breach of this commandment. The commandments run so deep. We've been seeing that every week. You know, last week, the sixth commandment, do not murder. You may not have murdered, but then murder never begins with taking someone's life. It begins with the devaluing of human life. We break the commandment when we put other people in danger, or even when we disregard people. So here in the seventh commandment, adultery does not begin with sex outside marriage. Adultery begins with a wandering eye. Or it can begin with inappropriate intimacy with someone who is not your spouse. So for example, when a married woman seeks her primary emotional support from a man who is not her husband, then she is dabbling her feet in nothing short of an adulterous relationship. And when a married man flirts with another woman, then he is giving to her the kind of attention that he promised only to his wife. The seed of adultery is just putting out its first little root into the soil of his heart. And who among us can stand up and claim that in all of our relationships and desires, we have lived lives of total sexual purity and fidelity? Who among us can stand up and claim that we are able to give the kind of steadfast, uncompromised love that we so crave for ourselves? We read from the Sermon on the Mount the words of Jesus in Matthew chapter 5. You've heard that it was said, do not commit adultery. But I tell you, says Jesus, that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. Now, I am a man, so I'm going to speak to men for a moment. For most men, lust is the battle that they are most conscious of in the Christian life, and the one in which they feel at their weakest, at least for some time in their lives. What Jesus is saying is that the problem lies in here, not out there. Now let's be clear what Jesus is not saying. He is not saying that it is wrong in and of itself for a man to look upon a woman with sexual desire. When Adam first looked at Eve, he was pretty charged up. This is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh, he says. I mean, he liked what he saw. And if you're in any doubt about the goodness of sexual desire, then you only need to go home and read, you know, the erotic language in Song of Songs, or you read how Rachel in Genesis 29 was beautiful in form and beautiful to look at. Jacob was attracted to Rachel, and it's pretty obvious why. So we dare not imply that God is down on sex. I mean, it's precisely the opposite. He wants to protect it from being cheapened. What is sinful is not the sexual desire per se, but the adulterous desire. The adulterous desire that lurks within us. The desire to have somebody outside the context of permanent, faithful love, that is marriage. Jesus is telling us that we cannot just blame society, which we're maybe prone to do in the church. You know, we lament the state of society, perhaps, and the church is often very good at pointing to the corruption that is at large, as if sin was out there. But Jesus says sin is in here. Yes, we live in a hyper-sexed culture, and the porn industry is bigger than ever. Viewing pornography has never been more anonymous. It It's never been more accessible. It's never been more affordable. It's a massive problem. And yet, according to Jesus, the problem is not out there, just out there on the internet or wherever. The problem is in here. Christian or pagan, married or single. We long for faithful, enduring love, but how easily we are drawn to what is superficial and cheap. The sobering reality is summed up in Mark chapter 7. Jesus says, "What comes out of a man is what makes him unclean. For from within, out of men's hearts, come evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, greed, malice, deceit, lewdness, envy, slander, arrogance, and folly." All these evils, Jesus says, come from inside and make a man unclean. Now, it would be wrong to think that the seventh commandment is just an issue for men. I don't pretend to know the female mind, but I think it was mainly women who were reading 50 Shades of Grey a few years ago. You may not have. I looked up an American newspaper. The book was released in March 2012. Sales hit 10 million about 6 weeks later. By the end of 2012, sales had risen to between 65 million and 70 million copies. It was translated into 51 different languages. And if you don't know about that book, then that's good. For women, too, there's a problem in here. And it's not just out there. Despite the fact that we all long for faithfulness and permanence and purity, we look within ourselves and we see the seeds of adultery. And the third point is that the result can be really ugly. Although the world likes to think that adultery is just a little bit of grown-up naughtiness, a little bit of fun on the side, it's far from fun and it's always ugly. People like to think that secret sin, because it's secret and it's, you know, it's not going to hurt anyone, they think. But sin is always social. Even if it thrives in secrecy and on secrecy, it's always social. And even if you're never caught, it'll damage your heart. It'll sear your conscience. And it will deprive the people around you from the person that you ought to be. If it's not repented of, it will always lead to something worse. For example, lust is, by definition, never satisfied. It's always hunting for something more and something else, and that's why, if given into, it will always lead to stranger and more horrendous perversions. On the internet, if you follow a lustful desire on the internet, it will not be satisfied with whatever you see. Instead, your lustful appetite will grow, and if unrestrained, it'll lead you on to more and more and more, and before you know it, you'll have gone to places you never dreamed you would visit. You will never satisfy lust by giving into it, and that's why it's so dangerous and so oppressive. And the fact that adultery and lust is inherently secretive shows how sinister it is, because when it comes out, like, the carnage is obvious, isn't it? The deepest and most intimate levels of trust are smashed. For the guilty party, there's shame and dishonor and disgrace. On the other side, there can be fury and bitterness and revenge. Families break down. Children are left insecure and without the nurture and example they need. Sometimes adulterers will often pride themselves that they still love their children, even if they no longer love their spouse. But they are kidding themselves, because the best thing we can do for our children is to love our spouses with unwavering fidelity. What a mess we make, though. And there's hurt all around. And God wants to protect us from that. He gives us the gift of sexuality, and he says, guard it. Guard it with all your heart. He gives us the gift of marriage, and he says, treasure it. Treasure it with all your might. The good news, finally, in all of this, is the message that we started with, that our God is a faithful God. He said he would rescue us, and he has not let us down. He knows when you've been sinned against, and he knows when you've sinned. And he sees the worst. He sees what nobody else sees. The hurts and the grievances, our sin and our shame. And just like he heard the cries of his people in Egypt and came down in mercy, so God pursues you and me with steadfast love. Like a husband who is determined to win his bride, he comes after us. And he came in the person of Jesus Christ. Only Jesus is totally pure and kept for us the seventh commandment. At every single point where we have sinned, Jesus lived a perfect life and he did it for us. But still, when he was 33, he was betrayed and he was abandoned by those who were closest to him. Thankfully, God knew what he was doing. He was actually on a mission to offer up his perfect life to God for our sakes. He was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. And he took our place under the wrath of God, bearing our shame, dying on the cross, so that we could be forgiven and reconciled with God. And now he's like the great doctor. Jesus is like the great doctor, able to put us back together again and make us whole. He said that in Mark chapter 2. He said, it's not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. I haven't come to call the righteous, Jesus says, but sinners. And really the church should have a big red cross on the outside, because it's like God's hospital, full of broken people who are hurt and sexually fallen. But Jesus meets us right where we are. And if we turn to him in faith and repentance today, then we can find that he gives us a brand new start. There is no sin so great that Jesus could not deal with on the cross. There is no hurt so deep that Jesus cannot address. There is no person so weak that Jesus cannot change. So today, if you hear his voice, don't harden your hearts as the people did at the time of Moses. We must turn to him today and find his amazing grace. So help us, God.